On this week's program, Susan Lewis considers art collectors Dorothy and Herbert Vogel and their gifts of 50 works to a museum in each of the 50 states, as well as related exhibitions at the Delaware Art Museum and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. We speak with Nancy M. Heinzen. Her history of Rittenhouse Square, The Perfect Square, is published by Temple University Press. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns profiles Philadelphia-based composer Morris Wright. And as part of Wicked Philadelphia, our continuing series about little-remembered events in local history, Tom Keels explores how the city of brotherly love was a hotbed for the world's oldest profession during the 18th and 19th centuries. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Herb and Dorothy Vogel didn't set out to become famous art collectors, but for nearly 45 years they lived on Dorothy's salary as a librarian and used Herb's income as a postal clerk to buy contemporary art, eventually amassing more than 4,000 works. Along the way, they attracted the attention of the international art community and the media, appearing on 60 Minutes, in People, New York, and other magazines, and were the subjects of an award-winning feature-length documentary, Herb and Dorothy. In recent years, the Vogels have been giving their art away, a large gift to the National Gallery, and, with that institution's help, 50 separate gifts of 50 works each to museums in every state in America. Now, with the opening of Vogel exhibitions at the Delaware Art Museum and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, WRTI's Susan Lewis considers Dorothy and Herbert Vogel and their gift to the nation, 50 works for 50 states.
In a park-like setting in Wilmington at the Delaware Museum of Art, a spacious gallery is adorned by works of 23 different contemporary artists, some internationally known. A 1996 study by minimalist Robert Mangold hangs nearby a work on paper by Robert Barry, known for his conceptual art. On the other side of the gallery hang a series of watercolor notebook drawings by post-minimalist Richard Tuttle. Assistant curator Margaret Winslow says this exhibition has been an opportunity to celebrate the Vogel gift,
but also to introduce this type of work to our visitors. We did not previously have holdings of this type of work in our permanent collection.
33 miles away in Philadelphia, work by a number of the same artists hangs in another large gallery at PAFA, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where curator of contemporary art Julian Rubson is similarly grateful.
It fills a gap in our collections. I don't think we have any Richard Tuttles except these. And this is a phenomenal Richard Tuttle gift to get. It's a phenomenal Robert Barry gift to get. Our strengths lie elsewhere. This helps us to really start to fill out the story of American art.
PAFA and Delaware are just two out of 50 recipients of 50 works each, representing a small fraction of the art donated to museums across the country. The thousands of works all came from a small one-bedroom apartment in New York City, where Herb and Dorothy Vogel still live after nearly 47 years. Still short of floor space, the walls still covered with art.
Actually, we had so much work on the walls. When we bought something, we couldn't put it up.
It was American art from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, into the 20th century. Work described by art scholars as minimalist, conceptualist, or post-minimalist, as well as some abstract expressionism and figurative work. Now in their 70s and 80s, respectively, Dorothy and Herb have stopped visiting galleries and collecting, but they are still eager art enthusiasts and completely unpretentious. Dorothy, with a quick wit and gentle smile, says up front that she studied music, loved theater, and initially knew little about art.
I didn't learn about art looking at slides. I learned about looking at work itself. And I never learned a vocabulary because I never studied art history. My experience is purely a visual one.
Although Herb studied art history at NYU, he also recalls an instinctive response to art.
I just liked it.
What makes you like a piece of art?
Well, the art itself. I don't have an idea of what it should be. I just look and enjoy it or not.
When they became engaged, they bought a Picasso vase to celebrate. Their first purchase as a married couple was a small sculpture by John Chamberlain, made out of colorful bits and pieces of crushed car.
I like the way something looks. It might be the proportion or color, or I like the arrangement. I don't know. It's like when you buy anything, why would you buy one car over another? Or one dress over another. Of course, you have to go by fit and size and price, but sometimes it just you like the way it looks.
Although when Dorothy and Herb married in 1962, they first set out to become artists themselves.
We got a studio that we shared with another artist, and we went there nights and weekends.
They also liked going to museums and galleries, and within several years had given up the studio to focus on collecting.
And my husband knew a lot of artists, and I met artists through him, and you meet one person through another person, and then it just developed into knowing a lot of people and being part of the art world.
Knowing a lot of artists meant learning about art through their eyes.
Sometimes they would be able to explain things, but it was interesting where we'd go to a studio, always being familiar with the work to begin with. We didn't like to go to a place if we didn't know the work, because that would be embarrassing if we didn't like the work.
Dorothy and Herb found their tastes compatible, if not identical.
Dorothy doesn't disagree with what I like, or I don't disagree with what she likes.
Our sensibilities were very comparable. He would go more for the flamboyant, and I'd go more for the hard edge, the more cerebral. But I think that our sensibilities did blend.
They bought drawings and other works on paper, paintings and small sculptures. Some works are studies for larger works. Their only criteria, other than liking it, one, being able to afford it.
We had two salaries. We lived on mine, and we bought art on his. So
yeah,
I don't.
Well, that wasn't rich, Dorothy.
No, but we had the one salary that we could devote to it. And also, it helped. It helped, yeah.
And two, that they could get it home and into their apartment.
The space problem never stopped us. We always found place to put something.
Although, as time went by, works piled up in cartons and frames stacked along the floor. Dorothy compares it to a book or record collection, where you know the work is there, even if you can't enjoy a particular piece at any given time. And yet, all that art eventually overwhelmed the small living space.
If we wanted to find something, it would be quite difficult. That's why it was great working with the National Gallery.
In 1992, the Vogels gave their first gift to Washington's National Gallery of Art, the first stop on their honeymoon 30 years before. It was a lot of art, even for the National Gallery, where curator Ruth Fine came up with the idea of the 50-50 project. 50 works to a museum in each state, which would agree not to sell any of the works and to exhibit them together within 5 years of the gift.
I always felt it is still our collection. Whether it's in our apartment at the National Gallery or in Philadelphia or in Wilmington, it's still our collection. We weren't going to sell it anyhow. So we have like 50 little Vogel collections throughout the United States.
Because of the depth and range of their collecting, each collection is a window into late 20th century art, as well as a story of how these two people of modest means made such a mark on the art world and continue with this gift to do so.
I don't think you should worry about it. Its worth. We never bought for investment because it can go up or down, but I think the important thing is that you like it.
Both Paffa's Julian Rubson and Delaware's Margaret Winslow see the Vogels as great examples of how to enjoy and nurture art.
I hope that viewers will see this show, this story, this gift, really as an inspiration to see that we each have the opportunity to be stewards for contemporary art.
And to think about what is it we think art is, and how can we explore our own imaginations with things like these.
The Vogels leave to the museums the promoting and interpreting of the art. Their goal is simple.
Just to share what we like with other people, but because you can't take it with you. And this way, the work gets to be seen. And the artists like the idea that the work is being seen.
Like the art they collected, Dorothy and Herb Vogel defy conventional expectations. With modest means, they acquired an extraordinary collection of valuable art. Unabashedly grounded and largely self-taught, they connect with the most esoteric of artists. And after decades of gathering works they love, they are now sending them off to spark the imaginations of strangers.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Dorothy and Herbert Vogel Collection, 50 Works for the First State, is at the Delaware Art Museum through August 29th. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts is presenting its gifts from the Vogels through September 12th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Tucked amid the bustle of downtown Philadelphia lies Rittenhouse Square, a bucolic retreat for city dwellers and visitors alike. This public space, spotted with trees, a reflecting pool and sculptures, has also become a status symbol for its residents. The park, one of the five open squares around which Philadelphia was organized, is the subject of Nancy M. Heinzen's first book, The Perfect Square. The book chronicles the many faces of the park throughout the area's history, featuring many archival photos and illustrations. Outside of her writing, Heinzen, a longtime resident of Rittenhouse Square, is involved with organizations dedicated to its upkeep and preservation. The Rittenhouse Square we know today as this very elite place to live became so in what, the early 20th century?
Actually, it became the place to live in the 19th century. It was the Civil War that made Philadelphia. And there were three things that made Philadelphia a powerhouse. One was the coal that was coming in from the northern part of the state. The other was large deposits of iron that surround the whole Pennsylvania area counties. And the third thing was the railroads, the mighty Pennsylvania. It was the largest corporation three times over in the world, and it was the great powerhouse. After the Civil War, the South was in a shambles. New England had some manufacturing, but Philadelphia, people don't realize this, but Philadelphia was the center of manufacturing and making things. And, of course, this gave rise to wealth. It created tremendous wealth, and the people who became wealthy had to have a nice address, a place to live. And this is, when people think of Rittenhouse Square and they think of wealthy, rich, elite, it stems back to that era.
But just as the railroads and the great fortunes that they earned for the residents of this area were one of the reasons why it became so prestigious, so too were these railway barons part of the reason that the square became less popular.
Well, what happened was the railroads were the downfall of Rittenhouse Square, because all of these people in their brownstone mansions around the square, heads of the railroads decided that they needed to expand, and what they encouraged their board people and their people who ran the railroad to do was to buy property outside the city and build summer homes. And these people built summer cottages, some of them call them, summer homes, out along what became known as the main line of the Pennsylvania Railroad. And they bought up large pieces of land, and they built very nice houses, and they decided that it wasn't bad living out there year-round. And eventually what happened was that the shakers and movers of the post-Civil War era became the new rich out on the main line, and the square more or less started to decline. Now, I'm talking about the 1900s. Early 1900s.
But not everybody headed off to the main line. There were still people who wanted to be here.
There were still people around who cared about the square and how it looked and what was going to become of it. And a group of them got together and hired an architect by the name of Paul Cray, who was one of the great architects of the Beaux-Arts period. He came from France, and they hired him to landscape the square. And he landscaped it based on a French park. This was an English square that got morphed into a French park. So this lovely French type of garden now was in Rittenhouse Square.
It's now really in its ultimate glory phase. It's one of the great addresses in the country at this point.
Well, it has this elan connected with it, but a lot of it is, you know, when you think of great squares, Lewisburg Square in Boston, Gramercy Park in New York, they all have this nice patina of the elite and that sort of thing. But there's a lot of commercial. I see it more like New York City's Upper East West Side. Central Park is 800 acres. Rittenhouse Square is 8. So if you compact that 800 into a little, I see it more operating like the Central Park area of New York. There's a lot of commercial, there's a lot of residential, there's just a lot of hustle and bustle.
Nancy M. Heinzen. Her book about Rittenhouse Square, The Perfect Square, is out now on Temple University Press. For many in the Delaware Valley, Lenape is a large high school in suburban New Jersey, a pizza place in Westchester, a golf course, and several sports teams. However, the Lenape tribe, who once inhabited the Wissahickon Valley, are the topic of the latest work by one of Philadelphia's most durable composers, Morris Wright. His violin concerto, Wissahickon Scenes, was built around Lenape melodies and saw its world premiere performed last month by the Philadelphia Classical Symphony. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports on how this unlikely cultural fusion was achieved and on similar endeavors that are in the air.
Composer Morris Wright was already quite sympathetic to the Native American culture when he was invited to write a piece for the Philadelphia Classical Symphony that somehow dialogues with the Lenape Indians. In the many creative travels of this near 30-year member of Temple University's composition faculty, Wright had even read the infamous State of the Union address by President Andrew Jackson proposing the 1830 Indian Removal Act as charitable treatment for a nation whose land had been stolen by white America. What Wright hadn't heard was Lenape voices. He had thought about doing some high-tech multimedia piece when Philadelphia Classical Symphony director Carl Mittleman told him about Native American field recordings made in 1928 on a primitive dictaphone and housed at the American Philosophical Society. Hearing them was captivating in a way that circumvented the usual reactions of like and dislike. In fact, Wright decided to include one of the recordings in his final movement.
It sounds very fragile, like it's barely there, like it may fade away. And so it was the fragileness of the document that struck me. And I like the sound of the chief's voice. And so it's a sense, I think, of this very beautiful document that was right on the edge of disappearing into the noise. And we played it at rehearsal, and everyone kind of it stops and thinks a little bit differently about the music after you hear these voices, or this voice from the past.
In post-performance conversations, violin soloist Hirono Oko corroborated that experience.
There's something more, the soul behind the music or something. Also, then I went back to my music and looked at, that's actually a prayer. So I said, ooh, I missed that part. Because you feel that from that. You know, it's a very simple melody. It's a very simple melody, but you feel so much from that. It's amazing.
Morris Wright chose about 5 Lenape melodies that he transcribed from the dictaphone recordings and often needed high-tech tools to slow and stretch these ancient songs so as not to miss a nuance. Several were incorporated into his 3-movement concerto, which begins with pleasure dances and then in the 2nd movement depicts the Trail of Tears as Indians trudged west, expelled from their land.
As you can imagine, I struggled with what am I going to bring to this?
Indian melodies are no stranger to classical music. Dvorak's New World Symphony has them, with many of the quirks ironed out so as to better suit the grand scheme of the piece. You could listen to it for years and not feel that there's anything Native American in there. More recently, the Native American plight has been confronted with a head-on frontal attack of emo rock in the show Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which has turned into a surprise hit currently at New York's Off-Broadway Public Theater. That musical goes so far as to present Andrew Jackson, the guy on the $20 bill, as a genocidal maniac. Morris Wright, however, refrained from any finger-pointing, working instead to unite 2 fundamentally different civilizations. Anything from Europe is inevitably based on the classicism of Greek antiquity. Those concepts of symmetry and proportion are usually behind most any creative act. The Indian nation had none of this. As a result, the music has an uncontained quality with constantly shifting meters and frequently repeating notes. As mercurial as it seems, the music wasn't improvisatory or accidental, Wright believes, but functioned mainly to intone words. That meant Wright sometimes had to decide what's an inflection and what's a change of pitch. Bringing together the two aesthetics without diluting either side would seem impossible, yet Wright seems to have done it.
Here is the prayer song called At the Hamlin Song, and I'll just play the tune for you. If you take just the notes of that tune, and line them up, there's kind of a nice fuzzy chord. Imagine you have a photograph and then you blur it so you get kind of a sum total of all the colors. I like to do that with pitches. And maybe mine that then to find chords that will come up. I wondered what would happen if I delayed the tune by a beat, since the repetitions of the piece delay it by a beat, and then played it a fourth lower. Here's the tune lower. Put them together and you get.
How much does it really matter? Regardless of what the music says to the naked ear, the concerto represents a metaphysical resolution that no treaty, no financial compensation for once stolen land, can accomplish. At a time when American society is increasingly fractured politically and morally, perhaps more than any time since the 1960s, any act of selfless conciliation between societies with a history of alienation, no matter how big or small, goes out into the world like a prayer.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Now, in the latest installment of Wicked Philadelphia, our series of features documenting lesser-known scandals in local history, Tom Keels explains how the world's oldest profession is also one of Philadelphia's oldest professions.
In August 1800, a group of concerned citizens in the Southwark District, along the Delaware River below South Street, decided to improve their neighborhood by torching a large chunk of it. An angry mob burned down the China Factory, a notorious brothel located on what is now Alter Street, between Front and Second. Clarissa Dillon is a scholar of 18th century Philadelphia.
Two customers got into an altercation, and eventually one of the combatants was knocked down and didn't get up. He was carried into an adjoining building where he died. And the law was called, and they arrested the survivor, and that seemed to be the end of things. But the next day, the neighbors came out and not only burned down the brothel, but the buildings surrounding it, as an indication of their disapproval of this whole thing.
The destruction of the China Factory marked a sea change in the practice of the oldest profession in Philadelphia. Prostitution, if not condoned, had been an accepted feature of life in the 18th century city. This was especially true after the Revolution, when, according to Dillon, departing British soldiers left behind an army of discarded concubines.
There really was nothing left for these young women, and because Philadelphia was a port and had sailors from all over the world whipping in and out, there were opportunities there. They weren't pleasant, but they were there.
After the Revolution, Philadelphia became the largest and richest city in America, serving as the national capital from 1790 to 1800. It also became the national party town, described by social historian Richard Godbeer as boisterous in body and remarkable for its lack of restraint. Dillon suggests that even some of our founding fathers may have taken advantage of the absence of the founding mothers.
I'm sure the politicians did the sorts of things they do now. It's just that you are careful of what you write down and what you leave for people to read.
In the 19th century, a wave of moral zeal pushed prostitutes out of Center City. In response, they followed the growing city north to the new industrial districts filled with single male workers. A vice zone, called the Tenderloin, emerged near Franklin Square. John Alvidi, senior curator of collections at the Franklin Institute Science Museum, defines the Tenderloin as
an area from 6th Street on the east to Broad Street on the west, from Vine Street on the south to Cattle Hill Street on the north.
A single block in the Tenderloin might have contained 20 brothels. These ranged from elegant and expensive resorts or parlor houses, where young ladies sang and played the piano in addition to their other talents, to cheap dives called loafer cribs. With so much competition, brothel owners relied on messenger boys to distribute advertisements to male travelers at nearby hotels and railroad stations.
Are you interested in a conversation with a woman? Are you interested in eating good food? We have the finest music available to you after hours, right? Because the resort or the parlor house that emerges in the late 19th, early 20th century are indeed places that have all those amenities.
One of the frankest and most infamous handbooks was the 1849 Guide to the Stranger, or Pocket Companion for the Fancy, containing a list of the gay houses and ladies of pleasure in the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection. The anonymous author raided nearly 50 Philadelphia brothels. One of the four-star houses was Miss Josephine Summers at Wood and 11th Streets in the Tenderloin.
This is indeed a temple of Venus, and we do most sincerely assure our readers that Miss Josephine is an accomplished lady. You can spend an evening here with great pleasure. The young ladies are all beautiful, accomplished, and bewitching. Go one, go all, and you will be pleased.
At the other end of the spectrum was Sal Boyer, known as Dutch Sal, keeper of a dangerous panel house, where sliding walls enabled her to steal customers' valuables while they were otherwise engaged.
This is the lowest house in the city, a perfect loafer hole. No gentleman ever visits this Sodom. It is worse than hell itself.
By the dawn of the 20th century, Philadelphia boasted an estimated 5,000 prostitutes, more than any other American city. Its powerful crime syndicate protected the industry with generous payoffs to police and politicians. And young women flocked to the life, attracted by what John Alvidi calls its unparalleled earning potential.
A woman who was a streetwalker in Philadelphia in the late 19th century could easily make in a day more than $3. A streetwalker at the highest level would make $3 a trip.
At the highest level, a successful parlor house prostitute might have made $300 to $400 a week. At a time when weekly wages were less than $20 for a skilled factory worker and $10 for a shop girl. Of course, the average prostitute's career was only about 5 years. Clarissa Dillon points out that violence, disease, and addiction have been integral parts of a prostitute's life throughout history and around the world.
Being a whore was not fun. There was a quote in one of Boswell's journals about a whore he took in St. James Park, and his comment was, "She was lean and dank, and her breath smelled of spirits. I never asked her name." And that is the most dehumanizing, awful statement.
After World War II, the Tenderloin declined, and brothels moved south once again, closer to the historic center of prostitution in Philadelphia.
WRTI's Tom Keels with the third of a five-part series called Wicked Philadelphia, which will be running throughout the summer. A companion book to these features is out now on the History Press imprint. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.